Talking Heads from the Chartered Institute of Internal Auditors.
From chaos comes order, but don't kid yourself, it takes time. However good the plan, however well trained the people, it does take time.
Lieutenant Colonel Richard Clements, CBE, on crisis planning, learning from experience on the front line.
So we have quite a lot in common. Both our respective professional bodies have enviable reputations based on long and distinguished histories. Yours back to 1948, mine perhaps a little longer, it goes back to 1752. But at the heart of our business lies risk. There are also differences between us. I sense, for example, that there could be a danger of being separated by common language. The abbreviation for Chartered Internal Auditor means something very different to me than you. The key difference is that my trade also includes a compelling requirement to create crisis for the other side. So kind of I'm looking at it both from the good guys and from the bad guys' perspective. This is how the military defines crisis. While it may seem pedantic, in our culture, and perhaps in yours, ensuring clarity and common understanding is imperative. When that clarity goes missing, problems quickly arise. With culture in mind, I'd like to share some aspects of what I'm broadly referring to as military culture that underpins our approach to preventing crisis. It's a multifaceted and constantly evolving to match the circumstances of an ever-changing world. It's simple. It's about behaviours and ensuring that they're constantly, consistently and unconsciously fit into the needs of the organisation and that the two, the needs of the organisation and the individual, evolve in tandem. So the first sensible question to ask would be why an organisation exists, what's its purpose? Everybody who's part of it needs to understand that. So each year, irrespective of rank, every soldier is required to undergo training that reinforces the understanding of the Army's values and standards, i.e. what sits at the heart of the culture. It's not something to be done by rote, but rather a process of inculcating principles and practicing their application in real-life situations. For us, it's very much spend to save. Get this right, and a lot of problems never occur in the first place. So how do we make sure that we have the right leaders and managers? After 4 days at the Army Officer Selection Board, individuals deemed to have the right intellectual and physical potential spend 11 months at the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, learning their trade. You won't be surprised that there's a heavy emphasis on leadership and on crisis management. We also have similar structured systems for developing our non-commissioned officers. You may think it counterintuitive, but in the hierarchy of the Army, challenge and speaking truth under power is embedded and clearly articulated in doctrine, which requires subordinates who don't understand a direction to challenge it. This may be contrary to the stereotypical portrayal of the military, but it is fundamental to how we operate. That's not to say that in the crucible of close combat, we seek alternative views about how to conduct a particular attack. But in most business, we encourage and seek different views to expose different arguments and perspectives. At the geostrategic end of the business, on another occasion, a friend of mine was involved where, famously, institutional weakness led to obvious risky outcomes. In this case, to put it mildly. Let me take you back to those heady days of 2002 to 2003. Remember those? When the challenge for government officials was in theory to advise the Prime Minister about the risk to the UK from Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. In truth, it was more political than that. It was the risk that after major combat operations were over, the weapons of mass destruction programmes uncovered might not appear to the British electorate to justify going to war. And why did officials get that wrong? Well, the inquiry, which was 2.6 million words and 12 volumes long, looked into that. My friend's rather more pithy lessons identified were these. Never, ever silence dissenting voices at any level in your organisation, however awkward they are. Find a way to surface the views. Indeed, this might be one of the highest challenges to business leaders, to find a way to insinuate a discordant note into a discussion without losing control of it. This is especially important when there is a strong consensus around a high-risk course of action. There is no alternative should ring alarm bells. Groupthink is a real phenomenon, especially amongst mature teams of experienced professionals who respect one another. Having touched on one or two of the cultural aspects that we believe helps prevent crisis, I'd now like to turn to some of the techniques we use in responding to crisis. I would add this is a snapshot of what is a much broader suite of techniques that are available to us. I wonder if any of them are applicable in the boardroom. Selection and maintenance of the aim. We spend a lot of time doing that to make sure we are doing the right thing, that unifying purpose. What are we trying to do? What is the whole organisation trying to do? I suspect, I've certainly seen this where this hasn't gone right. Afghanistan, 5 different missions, all viewed differently from different nations. Maintenance morale, particularly in the context of what's emerging at the moment. How do you keep the morale up in your organisation? It's an important thing. Security, self-evidently. Surprise. That for us, is really important if we're going after the bad guys. But equally, we need to inculcate into our people that you will be surprised. You know, always expect the unexpected because that's what will happen. Economy of effort, yeah. Don't use any more than you need to do. And that cooperation. Cooperation in amongst ourselves, with our allies, with the commercial sector, with industry, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot there. Okay, so we've touched on culture, we've looked at some of the process, and what I'd like to do now is just look at a terrorist attack that, frankly, I was far too closely involved with as a vehicle to draw out some of the aspects from my own experience that are key to managing crisis. This was a well-planned and audacious operation against a major military barracks, about 1,500 soldiers, and probably as many, if not more, civil servants and families living inside the base. So how did the terrorists do it? What did they do? They formed a small planning cell to both plan and execute the attack. Their intelligence preparation of the environment was fed by hostile reconnaissance conducted by insiders in the form of building contractors who were working in the camp, and what they gleaned from the internet. So between those two, they got a good idea, which allowed them to work out how to get in, where to place the bombs, and how to get out, in simple terms. So what happened? 3 vehicles, over the course of half an hour, drove in through the main entrance and exit. Heavily guarded, but the insiders had identified the explosive search dogs had been taken off duty. And so they started the attack. They'd also identified the pass system and how it worked. They faked up the passes along with, they'd faked up the cars to replicate, for example, my car, sort of a green Mini or whatever, with the right number plate. So it all looked good, which was a good bit of work. So the passes linked to the big smiles and a confident demeanor got them in. They then, the 3 cars over the course of half hour came in. They parked 1 near the petrol pumps, 1 near the medical centre, and the 3rd car, driven by a lady dressed to look as if she was pregnant, picked the other 2 drivers up and drove out of camp. The device in car 1 functioned, causing about 12 casualties, setting fire to surrounding vehicles and disrupting communications. As an aside, fibre optic cables and explosions don't go together, so the communications were completely disrupted. So when considering response plans, I've found it really useful to understand how people might react. Fight or flight really does exist, but so does training, and they will all kick in. Some people are overwhelmed. At best, they become passive observers. At worst, the impulse for flight is real. And they run and they hide away. Really inconvenient. They may also experience tunnel vision and deafness. This has nothing to do with blast damage. It's just the brain saying, thank you very much, I've had enough for the time being. And just think about the implications of that when you're trying to deal with people in these circumstances. Others thrive on the excitement, the exhilaration, the chance to do something useful, and they'll rush in and help. The point being that both groups need very clear direction. Somebody needs to take charge, take command of the whole thing. So the key stages in responding to an explosion that we teach are what we call the four C's. Confirm where something's gone off, clear the area, in the case of a car bomb, 400 meters around it. That means get everybody out, coordinate, and finally control access. In this case, after the explosion, the imperative was to move the 12 injured to the medical center. So back on the ground, the imperative was to move those people. And another challenge, and it's a set drill, is to check that the route from explosion one to wherever you're taking people is clear. Of course, actually, nobody thought to do it. And the result was that some 30 minutes later, the next device went off, and we ended up with 32 people injured, of which one sadly died later. It was about 12 hours before the situation could be said to be under control and the base safe. From chaos comes order, but don't kid yourself, it takes time. However good the plan, however well trained the people, it does take time. For what it's worth, here are a few key observations that I would offer in relation to dealing with the immediate response to an incident. And remember, this could be equally an industrial accident or whatever. It will be chaotic. You won't know until days, weeks later what actually happened. So go with what you've got, enjoy the chaos, embrace it, and just get onto it. I think that is a state of mind as much as anything, that you know people always want the facts, what's happened? Well, you're only going to get half of it. And for me, I always want to know where the bad guys are and where the good guys are. And that's all I want to know, and then I can get on and do my stuff. Somebody must take control. Remember what I said about the way that people... And that person actually is one who steps back and thinks, OK, before we move those people, we need to make sure that that route is clear. I majored on that, really. I think factoring it into your plans is important. Simple drills. Give people something to hang their hat on. Keep the plans brief. Talk about principles. Let them apply them to where you've got whatever situation they're faced with. Perhaps putting it on a phone app is one way of doing it. Another, frankly, is a NIREX folder, because the computer won't work, because the comms will have been disrupted, and frankly, people don't have time to get on the computer and look at plans. If it's more than a couple of pages long, it's useless, utterly useless, because people won't use it. And form a recovery cell. So as soon as you can, you put together, we always have groups of people who are trained, both civilians and military, who come together in a crisis, drop their day job, and they become responsible for running the whole recovery. And that includes the whole business of working out what has happened to who, because the last thing you want is incorrect information going out that somebody is okay or they're not okay. Liaising with the civil authorities, in particular the police. And again, don't kid yourselves, the police are on the scene for a long time. Welfare. There is a lot of welfare issues that tip out of this sort of thing. Any decent organisation will get in amongst it and sort it out. How do you go and inform the bereaved family? Well, we tend to train two groups, one to go and deliver the bad news, and the other to be there as long as necessary. I can assure you, and I think my friends agree with me, it's one of the hardest things I've had to do. So we've looked at culture, we've looked at some of the techniques, and we've looked at some of the sort of low-level responses to an incident. Now, I've been very privileged to have been involved in crisis for a long time, whether it's sitting in Cobra or the Cabinet Office or delivering down at the other end. And I think there are four enduring themes that go with this. And I think to professionals like you, there won't be any surprises. So leadership and management. Got to get it right. And particularly at the moment in the current context, leadership and management has got to be leaning right into this to keep their organisations up, running and working. The two have got to work in complete harmony. And the other thing I suggest is that it should be trendy for the leaders and the managers to say, I'm going to go and take some time to think. I used to work for a boss who ended up as the Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe. That's a big mouthful. And you couldn't get in to see him sometimes. And when you eventually did, he'd be sort of lying on the sofa in the office. And he'd sort of say, I bet you thought I was asleep, didn't you? Well, possibly so. And he'd say, no, I'm thinking. I'm paid to use my brain. And actually, it was interesting. I mean, there was a guy called Rupert Smith who was as close to a genius as I've ever come across. But it's that time to think. Culture, lived culture, something that really means something. I mean, how many times do you go into an organisation and see great glossy things about this is our mission, this is our task, but when you ask the receptionist behind the desk, they haven't got a clue. It means nothing. It must mean something. For us, spending the time, the money, is money well spent. Communication. And I would contend that in many ways we've got far too much communication that doesn't help. Less can be more. And then wrapped into the whole thing is training people, understanding what are those training objectives, why do we need them, why is it worth spending money, why is it worth inculcating those drills into people, getting that culture in and done.
Thank you for downloading Talking Heads from the Chartered Institute of Internal Auditors.